feels like there's a bit of a new mantra at the moment, isn't it? It's not so much education, 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 as community, community, community. And whilst the whole of the process of lockdown and the politics around it, there is this sort of word keeps bubbling to the surface, doesn't it? And I suppose what we've got to remember, Keith Committer, it's been around for quite a long time, hasn't it, this notion?
Yeah, it has. And I just had a flashback to my mother, who was German, and my father loving long words. And of course, the Germans are great at long words. And there is this word called Zusammengehörigkeitsgefühl, the feeling of togetherness.
Yep.
And of course, that's exactly what the word community is. Whether that's a literal translation, I'm not sure, but I love saying it.
I like that. Keith, how's your German?
Yeah, my German is even worse. a bit like Camilla, all of a sudden from this intro, I had a kickback to my time in Hull when I was responsible for overseeing 19 community centres as part of the Leisure Services Department. And the chairman in the end said, right, OK, I know what we've got to do now. We just got to put the word community in front of everything.
Yeah.
I think the heritage of the word is quite interesting. And actually, the organisation that we're looking at today is very much from a kind of, well, a Victorian tradition founded in 1885 in South London. Historical links between the organisation and the community itself has morphed and changed somewhat over those years. And I know, Camilla, that you know this organisation quite well. Before we introduce the person involved, just give us a sketch of this charity and how it works.
It's a settlement with originally people from outside the location coming into a particular location. The people coming in were meant to become part of the community. They were not meant to float in, give great solutions or hand out alms and then just leave again. They were supposed to live and become part of that. One of the interesting things for me about Pembroke House is where it's located in South London in the borough of Walworth, which traditionally, and if you go back to the 1880s, was depicted in Charles Booth's poverty maps as being on the scale of colours around the blue and black colour, which is the lowest colours, the gold and yellow being the very well-off who lived in Mayfair, for example. And the Old Kent Road nearby, on the edge of Walworth, is the cheapest property, as we all know, on the Monopoly board.
£60, is that right?
It is. 60 quid, and even the rents are low, interestingly enough, and that hasn't changed. But it may be changing.
You've done a bit of a reveal there. So our guest today is Mike Wilson, who is the Executive Director of Pembroke House. What do we want to ask him?
What is Pembroke House all about for me? Where's it going? And I think it also, for me, he is looking at a higher decision-making process by getting involved with government, the voluntary sector, to see what we can do going forward. So there's a lot there, I think, that we can try and pull out.
Alex Scales from the Centre for Charity Effectiveness is with us. Alex, your thoughts?
I think there's quite a bit around volunteering in terms of he talks about how they've had this tremendous upsurge. There's something in terms of how the organisation is going to keep that momentum going, that motivation and energy. And also, I'd be keen to explore the costs, because as we all know around this table, you know, just having a whole group of volunteers giving their time for your organisation doesn't come without costs in this health and safety crazy world that we live in right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, what kind of impact that's had in terms of how he operates and how he leads.
I better let him in because he's waiting. Our guest today then is Mike Wilson, the Executive Director of Pembroke House. Mike Wilson is the Executive Director of Pembroke House. He got into the charity sector by accident. Before that, he worked as an A-level ethics teacher and a civil servant. Pembroke House in Walworth, South London, has been a part of the community since 1885, a centre for social action and a residential community. It bridges divides, it unites people, and in 2020, since COVID-19 struck, 200 volunteers at the Walworth Community Food Hub have prepared and delivered, so far, over 10,000 food packages, 40 tonnes of food to local residents in need. And when their centre had to close its doors during lockdown, Mike organised a peloton of 50 cyclists to get the food out. Yeah. Talk about Dunkirk spirit. Mike, thank you for joining us. You define yourself as a settlement, a historical word which perhaps means something to some people, but not an awful lot to a lot of people. Tell us about what it means to you and how it defines how you work.
So settlements have slightly a hidden history, I guess. So Pembroke House was founded by students back in 1885, and it was part of this wider movement, the settlement movement. And really, it was a time of history in the UK, sort of a fascinating time. Post-industrial revolution, there'd been a mass migration of people into inner cities and the growth of these sort of slum or deprived areas that were cheek by jowl with some very well-heeled areas. And there was a sense of this sort of growing inequality in inner cities. So the settlement movement was born out of really some radicals, some students who were saying, OK, well, look, we need to do something different. And their sort of brilliant simplicity of their answer was to say, well, why don't we just come and live in some areas that are marked by that inequality. Let's come and settle there. So hence the word settlement comes from the word settle. So let's come and live. Let's come and set up a residency, a house. And let's start in those communities and work together with the people who are living there, the people who are already working there, and to try and come up with some local solutions to that inequality. The first of these settlements was Toynbee Hall. So it was founded on the East End in 1884. And really this idea caught the spirit of the age. And suddenly, over a space of a tiny amount of time, this is why we call it the settlement movement, a huge number of these settlement houses were founded across the East End of London, the South of London, then across the country, and then actually became an international movement. So there'd been this amazing history. And I guess the question that we've been asking today is to say, you know, that's very interesting, but what on earth does that mean for the challenges of today? Yeah. Once again, in inner cities, inequality is growing. And I think you could argue, maybe slightly more contentiously, that existing models of state, of market, and existing models of charity don't look like they're going to solve that inequality on their own. So the reason why I've got so excited by the settlement framework and the inspiration of some of these pioneers from the 19th century is to say, well, actually, the conditions are quite similar to today. And we actually need to come up with some quite radical new solutions to tackle the inequality today. So we've been asking what a 21st century settlement would look like. And that's the question that motivates all our work.
Camilla?
Has COVID in some way focused the question maybe even more tightly?
Yeah, it's interesting. So it's definitely, it's a question that started before COVID. One of the things I did when I first joined was look at the Charles Booth map of poverty that our founders were looking at when they were deciding where to found a settlement. And, you know, you see the area around Pembroke House shaded in black and dark blue. And these were the vicious semi-criminal, I think was the language they used at the time. So I'm glad we've gone beyond that language. But you can see there were areas of deprivation. And then the thing we did 6 years ago was then just look at a map, the IMDs, the Indices of Multiple Deprivation, and put that next to the Charles Booth map. And actually, it was shocking. What you saw was pretty much the same patterns of deprivation. And so now I'm looking at the particular area and saying, well, we've been there 130 years and we have not changed that map. So we have not done something at that local level to systemically change the inequality at that local level. And that was a blow to the face, right, for us. And it's been saying, well, we need to do something different. So we've been on that journey for 6 years. COVID has, if anything, it's revealed rather than caused the inequality that we're seeing, and it's exacerbated it.
Keith?
You've pointed out that, yeah, we've got to learn from COVID going forward. What at the moment, then, do you think are the key issues that you've had to look at that other charities may be worth considering now as well?
Probably quite a few. We've been thinking through a lot, but we've been on a journey for, you know, these last few years to try and get people to work across traditional boundaries. So to try and get charities to work differently with the NHS or with their local authority or with businesses. What we've seen in COVID is we've done more together across those traditional boundaries in the last 5 months than we did in the 5 years previous. So in order to be able to get the food hub working, we needed to work with our neighbourhood partners. So we had to speak to the school and the GP, and everyone was floundering around at the time to say, who is it who needs most help? Actually, the school could give us a list straight away of the 50 families who need it. And within that 50, the 10 who most need it now. So there was intelligence at a neighbourhood level. But then we were doing all of this in Woolworth, but there was a huge amount of intelligence sharing that we had to do with the local authority because who were held the shielding list and who also had access to the no recourse to public funds lists. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've been sort of banging a drum for locally is to say, we have to learn the legacy of that and we have to learn the lessons. Why did it work so well, that collaborative working during COVID? And I think there's a few things for me that are clear. One is during COVID, we've had a very, very clear common enemy. You know, we've had a clear vision to get support to the people who are most vulnerable. That's been matched by people coming to the table actually to say, what resources can I bring to that collective effort? Mm-hmm. Rather than your traditional, oh, I need some funding in order to do this, please can I have some commissioner or please can I have some funder? It's actually been saying, well, look, you know, we as a community centre have come forward and said, look, we've got some buildings, we've got some relationships. How do we bring them to this effort?
I think that's really interesting because I think one of the issues that I've seen, and I think this is what you're talking about, we've moved away from what's in it for me.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, what's in it for the people we're trying to support. I want to just try and pick up on the other bit now about you. I understand that after your time in the civil service, and I know how challenging that is, you decided to take some time and reflect and then come into the charity sector. Mm. Why was that?
I remember doing the interview for the civil service saying, look, you know, what's your motivation for wanting to come to the Home Office? And I said, I remember saying, oh, actually, I quite want to be a spy. And they were like, oh, wrong department, my friend. I said, no, not that type of spy. I actually want to know how it is that decisions get made in central government departments, because that's one of the things that I'm fascinated about. And I think my career, if you can call it a career, maybe like my collection of jobs, have all been sort of motivated by how do we make the decisions about the society that we live in? And in particular, things like the safety nets that we set up, such that some people seem to get caught by them and some people fall through them. But I was frustrated when I left the civil service because there didn't seem to be anybody who was really offering a way of saying, well, this is what life could look like differently. So I took a bit of a detour. I went to Chicago, did my master's in Chicago, came back to the UK, and I had probably a bit of an identity crisis. And that was where I first started volunteering at Pembroke House at their lunch club. And it was actually quite an important thing for me personally at that stage. You know, don't mind saying I was pretty low. And actually the volunteering there and the entry into a community was really critical for me personally at that moment. Right. And so I just got gripped by this idea of a settlement, this sense of saying we could do something very, very hyper-local whereby people have to come to it in a settlement way by bringing their whole selves. And then from that, thinking about how do we translate the lessons that we're learning in these local places to inform policy and practice further afield, to pick up those questions I was interested in about how we make society.
Mm. Alex?
I'm fascinated on the back of that. I mean, you've touched on, you know, this public sector into where you are now. And obviously the Kruger Report has recently come out with the word community used, you know, throughout. What are your thoughts on what actually emerged?
I have read the report and I guess what I'd say is there's not much that I disagree with. But the fact that there's not much to disagree with maybe as part of the issue for me is that I really think this work of cross-sector reform actually has to be quite bold and quite strident and is going to mean that some people disagree with it. If we take this community starting point seriously, we are going to end up with some statements that are going to be quite disruptive to the existing paradigms.
Yeah. I'm intrigued. So what for you needs to be done then? What is this parallel universe with a different organisation that's going to scare the shit out of people?
So if we now say, okay, we want to see a long-term change in the conditions of Woolworth, and we want to do that by working with the existing resident, in order to do that, we're going to have to change the way that decisions get made about Woolworth. So it would mean that we would need to start setting up some different fora in terms of how do we come together as a neighbourhood to begin to negotiate and say, okay, well, what do we want this neighbourhood to look like? And then how are we as a community going to start actually negotiating? Because there are going to be some significant trade-offs to make. Yeah. How do we begin to actually make those trade-offs and negotiate with each other as a community?
When a lot of chief execs just say, well, look, it's about who is controlling the stream of money at the end of the day.
Yeah.
If you have fora operating semi-autonomously with local authorities, surely it's still about who gives them the money.
The flow of money is critical. I think there's really interesting experiments. I'll give you an example. We were looking at setting up a community development trust in Woolworth. Then we actually stumbled across Queen's Park Community Council. You can set a referendum up that says we would like to exercise our right under the Localism Act to found a new parish council. And they founded a parish council in Queen's Park in West London.
Yeah.
And that gives them the opportunity to levy and raise parish council taxes locally. And then set up a parallel system of representation, right? I'm not saying that's what we should all do, but I'm saying that there are ways of disrupting the flow of money, whether it's taking something like the Localism Act and doing it in a different way, or in saying to the local authority, okay, well, if we're interested in a proper experiment, let's do a proper experiment about it. And it doesn't have to be the whole budget, but let's carve elements of the budget out and start saying, how do we make more democratic that accountability of the flow of money?
Alex?
You've even used the word experiment, and innovation is obviously coming throughout the heritage of Pembroke House. The leadership of the organisation, how aligned is that with the board, who perhaps aren't as involved on a day-to-day basis?
I think the board have been up for experiments in actually some pretty groundbreaking ways, especially for the recent history of the charity, right? So in the last 2 years, we've taken on a whole new site, the first time we're operating across two sites. You know, over the last 5 years, we've had a huge growth in the staff team and the size and the scope of the organisation. So I think they've been phenomenal through this. I think they also recognise there is an issue that the board is in no way representative of the local community. We're founded by Pembroke College students, and the board has to be by statute half Pembroke College members. And that means a number of them at the moment are Pembroke College fellows, academics in Cambridge. And they recognise the need to make the charity more representative of the local community. One way of doing that would be to say, let's set up an entire new management board and let's make sure that management board is entirely representative of the local community. And it becomes this sort of like slightly tokenistic tick box exercise. For me, the more interesting question is the more difficult question that says, OK, well, how do we take a board which recognises it's not representative of a local community, also wants to own where it's come from as an organisation. How do we do that transition? Yeah. And they are definitely up for that type of conversation, which I think is really exciting.
Wonderful.
Camilla?
Can we talk about food? You have suddenly turned into this emergency food hub. So, really down to the nitty-gritty, how are you going to supply what is an absolute need and yet give people agency at the same time over what they want, what they're going to do with it, who they're going to eat with?
Yeah, it is definitely it's the biggest challenge. We set up a food bank at the beginning of this because it was clear that this was the urgent need and it was the right thing to do in extraordinary times. Yep. I think all of us think it's an absolute scandal in ordinary times that people rely on that type of food provision. And I don't know any food bank really that believes in food banks. You know, every food bank wants to do themselves out of business. So we actually want to now transition out of it and come back to the vision that we had before. Now, the vision we had before, we talked a little bit about the Woolworth Living Room. The Woolworth Living Room is a big social space, community cafe. And the ethos and the aim of the Woolworth Living Room was, how do we use food as a reason to bring people together as equals? The challenge we have at the moment is we've set up a food bank. At its peak, there were 650 households who were receiving food a week. We've now whittled down a little bit to about 400 households. And we're expecting that to grow in the next phase of lockdown, and in particular as the economic crisis starts to hit. We've committed firstly to carry on doing the food bank a lot longer than we actually originally wanted to.
Really?
Yeah, because we could see people need it at the moment. We're now committing at least to doing it until the beginning of the next financial year. So now the challenge we're putting as a team is to say, okay, well, how do we take the ethos and spirit of the Woolworth Living Room and actually infuse that into the food bank model? So we're saying actually everything that we do now is about trying to create socially distanced connections, but create connection.
Yeah.
Because what we want to move away from is the service provision, right? This sort of transactional sense of we give you paternalistically what you want or what you tell us you need. Is it actually more authentic as a community food hub that people do get some things that they don't need and they swap them with their neighbour? Is that actually more exciting?
Yeah.
Because it creates the type of connection that we're interested in connecting. So we're thinking about overlaying onto a food bank the ethos and aims of a very, very different project.
It's really interesting because it feels very much like you had the intellectual framework for this. You had the model somewhere. How do you go about, as a leader, transferring that to the volunteers, to the people packing the parcels, to the people ringing up the supermarket saying, we need some more pasta? How do you go about doing that?
The key thing about settlement life is it's lived. You have to participate and you have to be there, which is why residency was always at the heart of settlements. It was a place where they lived and worked out their lives. And we still have a residency. We still have a residential element. We've got six people who live with us.
Just out of interest, that's a fascinating role for people. Where do they come from?
Yeah, it's an interesting. They're sort of 20-something-year-olds all doing jobs elsewhere, and then they commit to volunteering 5 hours a week with us. So recently we've had an architect in there. We've got a journalist in there at the moment.
It's quite a canny way of running the organisation, isn't it? Because you can sort of say, oh, what do we need? A chartered accountant.
Great way of supplementing your staff.
Yeah.
It really does, I'm afraid, work like that. It's brilliant. So we do put it out and say, OK, what are the skills that we need at the moment? Maybe not for chartered accountants, but that's a good idea. The key thing for me is it's actually an approach that's caught. Whenever I talk about Pembroke House, I always say, in normal times, I always like, come and visit. Let's sit down and let's have a cup of tea and let's eat some food. So in terms of like as a leader, how you do that, it's by inviting people to it. Yeah. And giving room for people to think about it slightly differently to you think about it, as long as there's some core shared elements. And I think some of those elements for us are about residency, wanting to do the work, wanting to learn. And this idea at the heart of the settlement movement that you've got more to learn than you have to give. Mm. So that humility that's always at the heart.
Just picking up on that, you got 140 volunteers to join to deliver your bike race, okay? A lot of charities out there are looking for volunteers. How did you go about getting that sort of number to come along?
Yeah, it's actually more than that now. I think there's 350 who have done shifts, and then there's many more than that who are signed up and still waiting to get into the shift backlog. And it's also quite funny the way that we've done it, because if you remember at the beginning of all of this, there was that massive clamour for people wanting to help. What we actually did was set out the world's most draconian volunteer form, and we made it unbelievably long because we thought we were going to get inundated. And we thought, let's make it really long and let's hope that that sort of starts to filter out the people who are ready to volunteer, really want to do it, who have already got DBS checks and stuff like that.
Called your bluff, eh?
Yeah, we thought, right, this will be great because it'll reduce maybe the stuff that we have to do on our side. So we opened it out on a weekend. I think we had 250 people sign up in 24 hours. And so we instantly had to close it down. So it was an amazing example of just like how desperate people were at that early stage to help out. And actually, one of the things that I would love to track through this, picking up on what we were just talking about, the settlement, as you've got more to learn than you have to give, is what are the things that have surprised people who have helped out? People saying, like, I've lived in this community for the last 5 years. I did not realise there were this many social housing estates here. I did not realise that somebody was still living at the top of the Aylesbury estate. I thought that was being demolished. I did not realise there could be a family on the sixth floor at the end of a corridor where every other house is boarded up. So there's been some really fascinating lessons. And I think, you know, back to the question about how do we inculcate this vision of a settlement amongst those volunteers, I think that's one of our big challenges now, because they've all, and most of those have come forward to say, I want to help out with a food bank. How do we keep that longer term engagement with the place?
And obviously using volunteers to that degree doesn't come without a cost in terms of employed staff's time and money. How have you dealt with that aspect?
Yeah, no, we've ended up having to expand during COVID, in particular on volunteer capacity. The bike delivery service has got a full-time person on it. The person running the food hub in terms of health and safety and food has got a full-time person on it. So these are all posts we didn't have beforehand. So we have relied on emergency funding. We also have had a huge number of donors come forward, like unprecedented number of donors. We launched a donor drive and have been shocked by, you know, how generous people have been. The thing we're scared about, I think every organisation is scared about, is we know that next year is going to be more challenging, probably with the economic impacts for people. And we know as an organisation, next year is probably going to be more challenging because there won't be the emergency funds. People have spent out. And then existing funders who we rely on for core funds, obviously a lot of their funds come from investments. So, you know, knowing that the climate next year is going to be harder than this year is very sobering. So looking at a budget for next year keeps us all awake at night a bit.
Yeah. One question which I tend to throw in at the end. It's not an easy one, I'm sure. What would you do differently now that you would have thought of it earlier on?
I think we would have been more front and centre about the living room and the aspirations of the settlement, even when we were setting up the food bank. So we would have been more front and centre that said that we're setting this up because we want it to look like this in the future. And actually having to now bring that in, having set up a traditional food bank and now having to bring that in is difficult. Yep. You know, I think as a team, we've learnt loads through this. I think we've underestimated, and I think not just us, but I think a number of people have underestimated the toll it's taken on the people who have helped. And I think we would have set up more at the beginning to put support mechanisms around people who are sort of burning themselves really at both ends to do this.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah,
fantastic. Mike, it's been fantastic to hear how you're approaching the situation at the moment, both in terms of inspiring leadership, new visions for the organisation, and a new framework for delivery of all sorts of provisions. So thank you for sharing all of your experiences with us. It's been a great joy.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you, mate.
So that was Mike Wilson, the Executive Director of Pembroke House, a settlement charity in South London. I know an awful lot more about settlements than I did 40 minutes ago, Keith.
Yeah, I mean, talking about how you get government, local authorities, local communities and charities working together, that's the biggest challenge. You know, we talked about the way that neighbourhoods work and develop. I can go back 25 years in Hull, where we said we'll have a neighbourhood approach. You know, it didn't work. And I think the reason why it didn't work is, as he was saying, everybody's got to get off their chair and sit on the same bench as everyone else and talk about the problems and how we can best solve them.
Camilla?
My experience with Pembroke House goes back a number of years. And what really fascinated me about Mike when he first came in was that he literally did go and knock on doors. So he has made himself known and made himself available. And I think in communities, there is always somebody who kind of gens everybody else along. And I think that that can't be overestimated. So when it comes to what he's doing at the moment in and around COVID, for example, he already had a reputation of being available, being a listener. And I don't just say him personally, but the organization, the settlement. Mm. So trust is probably at the key and at the heart of a lot of this.
Yeah.
They are a relatively small organization. Is there a way of, you know, almost getting that model and giving it a national base, basically upscaling what they are doing there and saying, look, here is a bigger outfit doing the same?
Well, he said himself, didn't he, start locally, and he used the word experiment and then to exemplify and take forward. And I guess they're going to have to find ways of really building their voice so that people do see their movement, their way of working as an attractive model that others want to experiment and try out. And linked with that is going to be the whole sort of risk appetite of these charities and their boards in terms of not just maintaining the status quo, but if actually the real root cause is going to be addressed, some risk is going to have to be taken to change that safe or typical way that they're used to organising in. I think it's really interesting. I don't think it's going to be easy. But, you know, if they can demonstrate the success, then it would be wonderful to see things like that taken forward.
Like you, I think he's got a good idea. He's got a good way forward. And I hope he can put together with other people that help him to deliver it. I loved his bit about what I would do differently, because he now almost feels he's got this big chain and anchor around his neck to keep doing a food bank when, thinking about it, it wasn't what he wants to do long term.
The whole food bank thing is the Bertolt Brecht expression, which is erst kommt das Fressen, dann kommt die Moral. In other words, first you got to feed people, then we can talk philosophy.
Where's this German come from, Camilla?
My mother was German.
Okay, that told me. Right.
I got a lot of stuff quoted at me growing up, Keith.
Right, we better wrap up before Keith completely implodes.
Yep.
You've been listening to Good Charity, Bad Charity. We thank the Centre for Charity Effectiveness and the City Bridge Trust, Dan Hardoon and Whistledown Studios for the production efforts. If you want to become a friend or a sponsor, then go and find us on goodcharitybadcharity.com. All our previous episodes are there and on your podcast provider. This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. I'm David Prest.
I'm Camilla McGibbon.
I'm Keith Davis.
I'm Alex Scales.
Goodbye.